Triple J the last few weeks. It's an album that once again has got a lot of people talking about this American singer. Some have been talking about why she appears to always be so sad and tragic in her songs, and also about how much of her life the songs actually document. This is, of course, if you consider that Lana Del Rey and Lizzy Grant are the same person. Lana told me that she doesn't feel like there is a division between the two, but she also said that there are still a lot of untruths about her that continue to get circulated about her background. I've never interviewed Lana Del Rey before, but I've always been intrigued by her music and also her life story. And a lot of her songs feel factual, but I've also thought that there must be an element of creation and myth-making in the process of her writing often such tragic songs. Now, I had 20 minutes to chat to her recently. She was in Paris, where she had just celebrated her 28th birthday with one of the first shows for this new album, and the French crowd at that gig had actually sung her happy birthday. Now, I wanted to cover as much as I could about the new album and to see where some of these ideas came from. So we started by talking about the fact that she re-recorded much of Ultraviolence with Dan Auerbach from the Black Keys.
Now, I was in New York at Electric Lady Studios. My best friend Lee Foster runs Electric Lady, and he had said, why don't you just come down and see what happens? And I started the record casually by myself with the session drummer and my guitar player from my band. And I think around December 20th, I really felt like I was done, but I wasn't really sure if I'd gotten what I wanted. And I went out to a club one night with my producer from my first record, Emil Haney, and he was going to meet Dan, and I had never met Dan before. And Dan was just really fun. And I told him about the record, and he said he wanted to hear it. And when he heard the songs, he said he really liked them, but if what I was going for was more of a West Coast fusion with the underground jazz appreciation, he said he felt like maybe I hadn't really gotten there yet, so he wanted to just take it a little bit further, I guess.
Yeah, but you were unsure with those recordings as well?
I liked them, but they were verging more towards like a kind of classic rock feel.
And you wanted something to be a bit murkier, a bit sort of more blurred?
Yeah, I guess I was, it's funny, like the word I was looking for was fuzz. And then after having read some of Dan's interviews after I worked with him, I was laughing because I read that he was known for his fuzzy guitar. So I thought, that's interesting. I guess he was sort of brought into my life for a reason. He definitely brought that kind of like casual but chaotic element I was looking for.
And he plays guitar on the tracks that you recorded with those new sessions. There are a few tracks on the record still from that first recording session, right?
Yeah, there are. Yeah, there's a few.
Okay. Oh, can we talk about one of those? We'll talk a little bit more about your relationship with Dan and sort of working with him. But Pretty When You Cry is one of my favourites from the record. At first I wasn't sure about
really?
It. Yeah, at first I wasn't sure about the track when I first heard it. It's got such a distinctive vocal right at the start. So this is one of the tracks that you did the first time round, and you decided to keep this. Can you talk about this track and also just that vocal delivery? Was that really hard to get?
No. Well, first of all, I mean, I'm glad that it stood out to you because for me, it really stood out to me. And sometimes it takes a long time for me to make a record, you know, for each track to be right, like the vocal delivery and the lyrics and the melody that accompanies it has to all be really cohesive. And Pretty When You Cry was one of those tracks. You know, I've had the same guitar player in my band for the last 4 years, Blake Stranathan, and he was kind of riffing on these four chords when I was at Electric Lady, just a couple chords he really liked. And we just turned the mic on and started experimenting. He played a little, 10-second interlude, and then I started singing, just sort of, I guess, ad-libbing. The reason why I like that song is because I kept it exactly as it was on that first try. And I think it's special for me because, like, there are no real, I don't know what the word is, like, affectations, no affects. Like, I wasn't really trying to put something on. I was just sort of feeling out the melody. And I like that it's organic in that way. And I think, for me, that's what the record was about, like, meeting people who were fun that I had chemistry with. So, yeah, actually, that song is kind of preserved from that very first take.
All the pretty stars shine for you.
Speaking to Lana Del Rey, we've got to talk about West Coast because obviously that was the first track, the first big single from the record that we got. Such a wonderful track. I believe that the record company freaked out a little bit though when they heard what you had done with the chorus.
Well, I think it was a combination of me telling them it was going to be like a record rooted in jazz with an easy West Coast vibe to it. And then the first song I showed them was like this song that was supposed to be a single that slipped into an even slower halftime beat during the chorus. I think they were like, oh, come on, can't you just for once, like, do something normal? But, I mean, you know, I kind of joke around about it, but the truth is they're so amazing. They kind of know I'm just going to do whatever I'm going to do. But, I mean, I love that song for the first kind of soft single just because the vibe is right and it sets the tone for this kind of West Coast feel. And Dan loved it.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's got little bits of his influence, obviously, on that track as well. And what about the lyrics? Is there actually a West Coast saying or did you just come up with that?
Well, that's what someone had said to me when I was on the beach. I was at a beach party and someone said, you know, they got a saying, if you're not drinking, then you're not playing. I thought it was cute. I thought it was a cute opening line.
Basically meaning that if you're not having fun at the party, it's because you haven't had enough alcohol.
Exactly.
How do you feel about that lyric as well? Because obviously it's been talked about before about the alcohol problems you had as a teenager. Did you feel comfortable singing that line?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like thinking about the way things were for me and what my inspirations and motivations were for so long. They still seem like a part of my life, even though I'm not drinking now. And, you know, for some reason, I still really enjoy soaking up the mood of, like, a really dynamic party, you know, whether it's on the West Coast or wherever. Like, because I like that other people can have fun and kind of let loose. I feel like I'm a part of it when I'm there. So, yeah, I felt comfortable with it.
And you don't drink at all anymore?
Not right now. I can't promise anything in the future.
Okay.
Depends how things go.
On Triple J, Lana Del Rey. There's more of the interview coming up in just a moment on 2014. She's going to talk about Lou Reed. She's going to talk about her thoughts towards her. I don't know whether Lou Reed was supposed to sing part of the song or whether the song was kind of half written and you were going to finish writing it with him. What were you thinking there?
Well, I had written it, and all the while I've been talking to Lou Reed's manager for a few months, trying to get over to New York just to do anything with him, really, just to meet him, say hi, and see what he was thinking. I know he was still writing. And, you know, finally, just on one night, I took the red eye overnight, and that was going to be the time that I hopefully went to meet him. But the morning, I landed at 7 in the morning, and that morning he had passed away. So, you know, I mean, he had never heard Brooklyn Baby. I wrote it kind of with him in mind. That was the track I thought he would really like.
How did you react when you got off the plane and you heard the news? What went through your head?
I was just shocked that just seconds after I landed that was the news. It was the timing of it that surprised me. I mean, obviously, I didn't know him, so it obviously resonated in a much more personal way with, you know, his family and the people who really knew him. But I was just surprised at the timing of it, just having landed and then getting the news. It was kind of just a strange feeling.
Mm. Barry, your life partner, your boyfriend, he co-wrote Brooklyn Baby with you, and the guitar chords kind of reminded me a little bit of some of the softer moments from the Velvet Underground. Did that kind of link you with Lou Reed with that song?
Well, I mean, I'm glad you got that from that. I thought it was kind of reminiscent of the underground stuff that I really liked. And that's why I was hoping if he heard it, he would like it too.
Yeah, it had that feel, that sort of pale blue eyes or some of that sort of softer Velvet Underground stuff with the guitar chords.
Yes, definitely. I really love that song from the record. And it's funny, like, how the production changes the song so much. You know, when it was a demo, it was more kind of singer-songwriter-ish. And then with Dan and with the band, it just took on this new kind of, I don't know, like, exotic Brooklyn feel, and I really loved it.
Well, my boyfriend. He plays guitar while I sing Lou Reed. I've got feathers in my
Del Rey is with us on Triple J. So let's go back to Dan from the Black Keys, and when you decided to re-record a lot of these songs with him, I believe it was very fast. Was it just a couple of weeks that it took to do most of this record?
It felt like longer, but I think it was 3 weeks with Dan.
3 weeks. Well, that's still pretty quick for, you know, what is a fairly substantial record, plus all the bonus tracks as well.
Yeah, definitely. On the CD
as well, on the inside, you actually say, thanks to Dan for bringing the fire back into my life. You have talked a little bit about with Born to Die, you felt that everything had been said for Lana Del Rey. Were you starting to lose the feel, the muse, or the passion for music at any point?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I don't really know where it comes from. For me, I'm so, like, instinctual, even down to my song titles. You know, sometimes I have song titles that are a couple of words that actually aren't even in the songs, and I never really know why I choose them, but they just sort of feel right. So for me, kind of being driven by instinct and intuition, it's important that I'm always in the right place at the right time. And I don't know, sometimes with touring around or, you know, not really being in one place, I mean, I think that's what makes it harder to write for me. And also, you know, I knew that a lot of people didn't like the first record, and I thought, well, you know, I'm not really sure how much I want to go down the line investing so much passion and love in another record. But, you know, at the end of the day, what was kind of funny was, it had been talked about so much that 2 years later, I actually felt more free to just write whatever I wanted because I kind of knew what was coming anyways. But the thing about Dan was he was interested in me and he was interested in the record. And it kind of, I don't know, it made me feel interesting again. You know, sometimes it's down to you and sometimes it's down to another person. So for me, it was like, it was about another person this time.
Yeah, you have said as well that you don't feel sometimes that Lana's taken seriously as an artist. That's, I mean, even Born to Die, I mean, it sold millions of copies. You know, you won a lot of fans worldwide with that record, but still you feel like the recognition and the reaction from some people is not quite right towards Lana Del Rey?
Well, I mean, I guess I felt like there was a lot of miscommunication, and I think it was because I was sort of a quiet person, so by the time I had even done my very first interview, there had been so many things written that weren't true. And sort of recycled, it's still a recycled little story about kind of how things became the way they were. And I guess it bothered me, considering they were just so far removed from my own experience. I don't even really know why it bothered me. It wasn't like a personal thing. It was more, I wanted to make sure the music was okay. I just wanted to make sure, you know, like the story about the songs were intact. And I think, you know, when people have their own impression about how you got to where you got to, it changes their mind about the music. Sometimes it's hard to listen to the words when you're thinking about the person. So I kind of felt like my own story was in the way.
There is also, with the creation that you've come up with Lana Del Rey, I mean, it is a vehicle for you to explore some things which might be reflective of what you've experienced in your own life, but you can explore a whole bunch of other things and personalities that maybe you don't live out in your everyday life. Is that true?
It's true that you can do that, yeah.
This is where the confusion, I think, for a lot of people lie. They don't know whether this is Lizzie or Lana. They kind of find it very murky, which could be the power of the music of Lana Del Rey, but how much of Lana Del Rey is actually you?
All of it. I think that, like, the culmination of me changing my name on top of stories written that were more think pieces rather than question and answer interviews led to this misconception that there's, like, a division between people. For me, I mean, it's, like, a pretty fluid transition from being on the stage to then being off the stage in my personal life. Obviously, I write about a couple of things that maybe aren't that relatable, but coming from, like, a more alternative background where I sort of got to write whatever I wanted to and was sort of invisible for 7 or 8 years, I never really had to censor myself and definitely never had to talk about what I meant. You know, it's obviously changed in the last couple of years, but for me, there's, like, no persona. There's a world. There's, like, a visual world that I love building through editing and directing and creating the videos. But in terms of, like, a personality divide, I don't see one.
Provocation for Lana Del Rey is a very strong element of what you do. It's still here on this record, too. Do you enjoy that?
I'm not a natural provocateur. I'm not really flamboyant in my personal life or on stage, so it's not really something I go for. But I like to be playful lyrically. I mean, I enjoy writing. That's kind of my passion. So if I use innuendos or metaphors instead of, like, saying things directly, or sometimes I say things directly without using innuendos and metaphors, you know, it depends. I'm always flipping. I'm flipping over my words sometimes in the same sentence. You know, sometimes I'm referencing something, and sometimes I'm being really direct, but I'm sort of, like, blurring the lines between the two just because I'm not sure how personal I really want to make it.
Lana Del Rey there, having a conversation with me recently about ultraviolence. Okay, what did she say about coming back to Australia? I'll let you know in just a moment. Let's hear another track from the album right now. So, what's this one? Is this innuendo? Are the lines blurred on this one? This is certainly a provocative piece from the album, and there is some strong language in this next track from Lana Del Rey. Kingsmore with you tonight on Triple J. So I did ask her, when is she coming back to the country? And she said nothing definite at this point, but she is hoping for a tour at the end of the year. That's what she's looking at anyway. If you came in halfway through the interview with Lana Del Rey, it will be in the stream of the show straight after the program finishes.